Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. The last time I did this show, it was June of 2012. Today is the 19th of April, 2016. The lapse of time in there had many causes. I apologize. I'm gratified that I received so many emails and letters of support, money, and people begging me to return. I had no idea when the voice of reason asked me to do this. I turned them down over and over again, and they sent me all the equipment, very expensive, knowing that I'd be too lazy to send it back. So I felt guilty. I had all this stuff, and then so I started doing the show, and I became the main draw in that area, on that network. And all these things are these dry university-style lectures with me and nothing else. There's no props. There's nothing except the information. But apparently there is a demand for this. These last 4 years have been absolutely disastrous for me. I've been through personal issues. I hit complete rock bottom. In every way that you can hit rock bottom. In many ways, that wasn't a metaphor. But I have relocated. I'm now in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is the most Orthodox and Slavic city in America. I have rebuilt completely. So thanks to the work of Matthew Heimbeck and so many others the traditional youth movement and Workers' Party, Matt Parrott, they have given me the opportunity to start this over again. My website has been revived. This time it's rusjournal.org rather than .com, rusjournal.org. And for the most part, it's just where my more recent essays are in PDF form now. But by far, more than anything else, this podcast system, style that I have, has been the most influential thing that I've ever done. And I simply can't believe it. It couldn't be any more dry and academic. I couldn't be any more pompous and condescending. And yet there is this hunger for this sort of information. People tell me that it's like going back to college again, just without all the stupidity. And that's, it's been tremendously gratifying. I mean, I have been begged to do this, and I can't believe it. Especially the living hell that I just have come out of, the destruction of everything that I had. Having this kind of support and these people writing me all the time, and people out of nowhere writing me and saying that they have converted to Orthodoxy because of me, because they've changed their political opinions because of me. It's incredible. Sometimes I simply refuse to believe it, that anyone could be that crazy. Matthew Heimbeck is my spiritual son and a good friend of mine. And actually, that is going to be the topic today. He was excommunicated by the Orthodox Church of Antioch. And I use the word Orthodox in quotes. They're by far the most liberal Masonic Orthodox body out there. They're an embarrassment. I don't get involved in these questions, whether or not these groups have grace or not. I think that's stupid. If there is any Orthodox group that has simply been cut off from the church through their liberalism and just general stupidity, it's the Antiochian church in America. Matthew Heimbeck was excommunicated on the grounds of philotism, ethnophilotism. And I I was shocked at a few things. I was shocked, number one, at the level of historical illiteracy that these people actually believe that philotism is a real heresy, and that that synod of 1872 actually had any kind of religious purpose. That number two, that they interpreted it so badly that any kind of organization on ethnic grounds, by whites specifically, was grounds for excommunication. Number three, that it was done by a body that is so liberal, that is so non-canonical, that violates canons, as almost a sacramental lifestyle, that they dared to judge anybody else. It took me a while to recover from that news. And Matthew, being very scrupulous, was extremely upset by that. He has come to the Greek old calendar movement, thanks to me. I come from the Synod of Auxentius, that is to say, the Archbishop of Athens, Auxentius, who was the successor to the first old calendarist bishop and metropolitan, Chrysostomus. This is the Greek group that had broken away from the Masonic Patriarch of Constantinople, based on liberalism, ecumenism, the new calendar, and this general modernization. And at the time, it's extremely large. It is a mainline body, believe it or not. However, the leadership is so incompetent. They have now split into so many bodies that, I do this full time and I can't keep up with them. The true Orthodox Church has failed to offer a compelling alternative to the modernists because there are so many groups, and that these groups have anathematized each other. There is no way that even a well-informed, intelligent Orthodox person can make a decision. And it's a deadly sin on their part. And these schisms that have occurred over the years have had no dogmatic foundation. These have been simply matters of personality, of finances, of personal arrogance, that the people in all of these bodies are identical, and yet they hate each other because of the actions of these incompetent, very sinful, nasty, vicious, and often ignorant bishops. Nevertheless, the true Orthodox Church, the old calendarists, number in the millions, and the largest in the Greeks was the Synod of Auxentius. And he formed a synod in Portugal in the 1970s, many of whom were involved in reviving the ancient Western rites of the first millennium. And that became, over time, the Synod of Milan, and then that became the Autonomous Metropolitan. And I was ordained a priest by Archbishop John, not entirely voluntarily. I didn't want to be a priest, and yet the bishop said that you really don't have any choice. There is no true Orthodox body around you, and your family needs the sacraments. And so I said, you're a terrible judge of character, but I took orders anyway. And this year, this November, will be the 10th anniversary that I did that. And I generally regret doing it, but I also know that this is in God's hands, not mine. And it's his decision, not mine. I am a very bad priest, however, and I want to make that clear. However, as it turns out, because of this radio show, there are many who take me seriously. So you're not very good judges of character either. Now, the topic here is that excommunication and the notion of philotism and this idea that you have these pseudo-intellectuals in these new calendar groups who they'll use this esoteric term and they'll look very smug when they're using it, and they think that they have stated something very very profound, and they don't realize just how stupid they look and how stupid they sound in using such terms. But Americans are not known for historical literacy. American Orthodox are really are a disastrous group of people, myself included. And we simply don't know. I mean, there's nothing in American life that lends itself to the Orthodox tradition. So unless you are isolated from the world, you really can't live it. The other alternative is to do what these Antiochians have done and just sink themselves into this bourgeois political order. Now, there is nothing in common between the modern liberal order in America and Orthodoxy. They are complete opposites. You can't be a modern American Orthodox person. That's like being a Catholic orangeman. It just doesn't make sense. Philotism, though, even if it was a real heresy, still is being misinterpreted by these people. Because they lack identity, because they have no identity themselves, because they live in a completely cultureless world. The United States is the first cultureless society. And with all the mental illness and neurosis that you would expect from such an experiment, any connection ethnically to them is seen as suspect. They don't understand it, and they hate what they don't understand. They themselves are a completely cultureless void. They have the liturgy, which they are always changing, which is a Byzantine development. But of course, they want nothing to do with Byzantium. They want nothing to do with monarchy, the Greek nationalism of the later empire. And they go out of their way to make themselves appear to the system as harmless as possible, to convince the regime that they don't threaten them. And as a result, they get the rewards of being mainline and they get the income and the support of the system. The World Council of Churches is a deeply corporate body financed by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, George Soros, Archer Daniels Midland, and groups like the OCA and the Antiochians have received money from these bodies, so they're on the corporate payroll. These organizations don't come from nowhere. They're not spontaneous. They're not spontaneous organizations. They exist to take the Orthodox tradition and to destroy it. But today, what we're talking about is what was going on in 19th century Greece and in the Fanar, which is a section of Istanbul, Constantinople, after the Turks had taken over, where a small group of Greek elites had become the intellectuals and the bankers and the capitalists to the Sultan. A tiny group of Greeks, a large group of Jews, a handful of Armenians, a handful of Italians, at least at a certain point in the very beginning, in the 16th century, did very well under the Turks. The capitalist financiers of the northern Italian city-states did very, very well. When Constantinople fell in 1453 and Orthodox Byzantium was extinguished, the capitalists, of course, having no identity themselves, immediately began trading and organizing with the Turks. They don't have, money has no identity. Profit has no identity. Usury has no identity. Money is a purely quantitative measure. It only has value because people are convinced that it has value. It's about brainwashing. It's about alchemy. It's about dead matter being seen as somehow fertile. And they formed the church as well, the so-called Patriarchate of Constantinople, in this period of time where Greece was under Turkish control. So from 1453 roughly to the middle of the 19th century was an extremely dark time for the Orthodox Church in the Balkans. One of the main reasons for this is that every see, every bishopric in the Orthodox Church under Turkish rule had to be bought. The Patriarchate itself had to be bought, and it was very expensive. So these people, the Fanar elites, had captured these institutions, needed quite a bit of money to pay the Turks, other bribes along the way. And then, of course, to maintain that position, they also had to pay a yearly fee. So it's no surprise to learn that the Turks overthrew patriarch after patriarch after patriarch. There were several hundred patriarchs of Constantinople in this relatively brief period of time. Many of them were murdered. Many of them were forcibly retired. But the important thing to notice is that a lot of these guys knew very little about Orthodoxy. While the Patriarchate was always, you know, at least formally coming from the, you know, the monastic ranks, many of the bishops in the Balkans and in the Middle East were not. Now, these were considered business investments. They were seen as investments rather than a specifically religious institution. And however, to buy these sees, you had to have money, you had to have contacts, you had to be a part of either the Fanar network or the Jewish network. And the way that you made your money, of course, was to tax the people, the townsmen and the peasants under you. So as it turns out, these Greek elites, the so-called archons of the Greek people, is what they call themselves, had every Orthodox see in the Balkans. Many of them never saw their cathedral, they didn't even see their see, see their diocese. But they bought it, and they, through taxation, hopefully, would make a profit. And that was very difficult to do. You had to be extremely unscrupulous. You had to tax the population beyond endurance to be able to pay back your creditors, the usury, and then keep a certain profit for yourself. They began to engage in a very obnoxious practice, and that is that they would find an excuse to place a village or a city under interdict, to place it under excommunication, which, by the way, also is something that had to be bought. The Patriarchate was selling anathemas in the same way that prior to the Reformation the popes were, not the popes necessarily, but those working for the popes were selling indulgences. The point was that if you placed a village under anathema, back then excommunication actually meant something. You lost all civil rights. You lost all right to property. You lost any claim to an inheritance, to lands, to anything you may have, your position in the guild, all of this was gone if you were excommunicated. So when these Fanar businessmen would figure out a way, some excuse, to put a village or a town under anathema, they had to buy that anathema from a patriarch, or they could do it themselves, allegedly being the bishop of the area, at least in theory. All of that property, the entire area, was then up for grabs. They would then take it and sell it and take whatever wasn't nailed down. And this way, they would be able to pay their creditors and make a profit. So that's the context of this situation, the creation of this fake heresy of Philotism. Needless to say, there was quite a bit of contempt for this. The church lost, through no fault of its own, these people. I mean, this was under foreign occupation. The imperialist Ottoman government ruled these areas and profited from the corruption of Orthodoxy, and they tormented the church. It was simply a dark time. Orthodoxy itself was not to blame, but unscrupulous people. In a situation like that, those who would rise to the top would be the worst of the worst. To become a member of this Fanar cult, you had to be pretty unscrupulous to begin with. There were exceptions to this, but this was a small group of traders who worked for the Turks and profited from it. The church had lost most of its influence, at least at the top. Orthodoxy continued to exist, but in a very low state. It was a populist peasant religion, and the average bishop was non-existent, and taxes were very, very high. So when the Slavic nations finally began to throw off their chains in the 19th century, they one of the first things they wanted to do was throw out these phony bishops. They, of course, were all Greeks. They didn't speak the language of the people under them, of their diocese. Many of them were not religious. Many of them weren't even priests. Many of them were never even there. It was just an investment. Getting rid of these guys was absolutely essential. The Bulgarians were quite militant in their national awakening in this time. They hated the Thanar Greeks, and with very good reason. And so they formed their own Bulgarian diocese, a so-called exarchate, to challenge the Greeks in Constantinople. They began, as the Bulgarian state started to consolidate itself, they began to throw these characters out and replace them with actual bishops, Slavic speakers, monastics, many of whom were nationalists themselves. And the result was that these Thanar bishops were out of luck. They couldn't tax the population anymore. They still owed all this money. They were in some trouble. So since they controlled the Patriarch of Constantinople to a great extent, at the very least, the Patriarch owed them quite a bit of money because they have their see they had to pay for it. They then created this so-called Synod of 1872. And in this synod, they condemned the Bulgarian exarchate. And they came up with a term. The term is called philotism. From the word phylum, a class, a tribe of people. The claim was, of course, it is a completely ridiculous claim, that these Bulgarians were organizing according to ethnic and linguistic terms and forms, which, of course, is how the Orthodox Church happens to be organized. So that's very curious. They made the claim that the exarchate stated that only Bulgarians could be a member of it, which is laughable. They never made that claim. Orthodoxy has always been organized on ethnic terms. It makes perfect sense. And certainly has never been organized based on territory. Territory is not something that's being sanctified here. It's only the people on it. The reason that Orthodoxy is organized that way is because they want bishops and monks who speak the language. They need people who know what's happening on the ground. Remember, in any diocese, the bishop is a spokesman for the synod. Everything in Orthodoxy is synodal, is based on a council. In every diocese, you have certain priests, laymen, monastics, who form the diocesan council. These are the people who are supposed to elect the bishop, and the bishop ends up being their spokesman. This is the reason why bishops always refer to themselves in the plural. It's always we, because they're not acting only of themselves. So we need to be very careful. It's often, Westerners, when they approach Orthodoxy, they think of it in very bureaucratic Roman Catholic terms. Bishops have a specific function, and that function is to organize the life of the diocese, to organize the finances, where the priests are supposed to go, discipline the clergy, to oversee the monasteries and church property. Generally speaking, that's asking a lot. They usually can't do that right. Once in a while, you'll find someone like John Maximovich, who is a saintly man, although in his case, he didn't care very much about the administrative elements that are essential to the life of a bishop. In the Orthodox Church, the only thing that matters is function. Different parts of the church are differentiated only by function. They are not in any hierarchical form. There is no special grace that only a bishop has and everybody else doesn't have. Their function alone is different. It is an error to refer to the church as the bishops. The bishops and synod get together, therefore the church has gotten together. That isn't true. And it was very much the case that it was even less true at the time where these bishops really didn't exist. needless, it couldn't be more obvious that the Bulgarians, in throwing these people out, acted justly, acted properly, that their anger and irritation at the Fanar takeover of these dioceses was justified, that these Greek businessmen pretending to be prelates had absolutely no right to be bishop of anything. And so that aspect of it, you say, you know, the church, Constantinople, got together in 1872 to condemn the Bulgarians because they threw out, they were stopping the income that this Fanar cult had. Their investments were now no longer going to be profitable because they were being kicked out of these sees. These dioceses were seen only as investments, not as religious bodies. The Slavic nationalist movement was kicking these people out. As the Ottoman Empire disintegrated, a strongly populist and nationalist movement took over. When the Fanar began to panic, they called the synod and condemned Bulgarians on laughable grounds. They're laughable for a few reasons. But number one, there was nothing wrong with organizing according to ethnicity. One of the more attractive aspects of the Orthodox Church is that it's organized ethnically. You have various Greek dioceses, Bulgarians, Romanians, everything else. It is not based on territory. It is based on the people, wherever the people happen to be. There's nothing special about territory, but there is something special about the people. A nation is a cultural and linguistic community. It manifests itself in law, in general attitude. It's an extension of the family. It has nothing to do with the government, the state. It is a cultural institution. Now, I came up with the phrase a long time ago, structures of survival. And what I mean is that ethnicity really comes down to the institutions that a group of people will devise under periods of great stress. Institutions and ideas and rituals that they come up with that maintain their existence under times of foreign occupation and genocide, like under the period of the Turkish rule, Turkocratia in this case, is the term. And the Bulgarian concept here is perfectly legitimate. The ethnic idea, the national idea, is that these structures of survival now take political form. This is how this group of people function. This is how they exist at all. And when the time was correct, when the Ottoman Empire began to fall apart, when European powers were growing and were outstripping the Ottomans in various ways, when the Cossacks and the Russian Empire had done tremendous damage, the Turks militarily, these groups rose up and demanded their independence. Each ethnic body, upon achieving independence, has, according to the canon of St. Photius and others, has the right to its own independent church body. So to claim that the ethnic principle, number one, is a problem is stupid. Number two, that this is cause for a condemnation, a heresy, and naming it something stupid like philotism, sort of like tribalism, is nothing more than the wealthy panicking because their investments were now being taken over by someone else. That's all this ever was. But number three, it's also stupid because the way it's being interpreted now is any form of ethnic connection at all is now in the minds of several in the Antiochian church and other related bodies, I guess, something horrible, something that is to be rejected. They're scared of it. Themselves, they have no culture. They are individualists. They live the alienated, neurotic life of the typical American. They're no more Orthodox than the table that I have my hands on right now. They're an embarrassment, and that they have the temerity to excommunicate someone based on this ridiculous heresy that came from the panicking wealthy of 19th century Constantinople. just shows you how stupid they are. It is historically illiterate. It is arrogant. And finally, someone needs to explain to them just how stupid they are. Now, they probably know this. They know that their point of view is absurd. But their concern is not the truth. Their concern is to let the system know that they are harmless and that they are part of this new world order, globalization, the global liberalism, which they are supporters of. And in removing people like Matt Heinbeck and others, they are currying favor with the powers that be. Those of you who have heard my shows in the past know that I use a few terms in a tactical way. The New World Order, for me, is just another word for Antichrist. I mean, the Antichrist. The end of all things. And that it functions as an individual. It is a single principle, a single idea, and therefore, and of course it has global reach, and it is economic at its root, and therefore fits the theological conception, Book of Revelation, Isaiah, Daniel, and all the other prophetic books of the Old and New Testament. It is really, though, a coalition of different bodies, liberal and leftist groups of various kinds, neoconservative groups, materialists, you know, feminists, on and on and on. The purpose, of course, is to create a single world market where transaction costs are reduced to the absolute minimum, where wages are reduced to the absolute minimum, where capital is being brought to the absolute cheapest it could possibly be, as a growth, you know, the elimination of borders and therefore the elimination of transaction costs. In the process, of course, it has to destroy nations. It has to destroy what makes human beings distinctive. Therefore, they adopt ideologies that do battle with the one enemy, and that one enemy is nationalism. Today, there is one group of people who have stood up and fought successfully against this New World Order, and that is the Russian nation under Vladimir Putin. I was the very first one to make it plain to the world when I was first hired by the Barnes Review in 1999 that Putin is going to create this coalition against the New World Order, against global capitalism, and instead fight for regionalism and nationalism and localism as an alternative, a multipolar world rather than a single world. I was the first one to say this. I was all alone. No one else was saying this at the time, at least in English. Now, I was working at the Barnes Review and Spotlight at the time, and I slowly but surely converted Mike Piper and Willis Cardo to my point of view. They then converted a whole bunch of other people, and then now it's a bandwagon, and I'm quite proud, very happy to have been the originator of this. I had taught myself Russian and was continued to read the Russian press and of course specialized in Russian history. And but I want to make it clear that this stuff didn't come from the sky. This bandwagon came from me. And because I was in that excellent position as the editor of the Barnes Review and of course involved in the American Free Press and Spotlight before that, and had the ear of people like Mike Piper and others, that I was people on the, we could vaguely call the right of the political spectrum, began to see Putin in a very different way. I mean, in 2000, he was condemned as just another KGB hack, as a reactionary. I mean, depending on what, you know, point of view you were starting from, you had reason to condemn him. Early on, the press in the West had declared war on him. And people began wondering why that's the case. He is accused of every possible crime. And I'm telling you something, no Soviet dictator was ever treated as harshly as Putin was. That'll be a period of time for another show. But the Cold War is a myth. The U.S. was so heavily invested in the Soviet Union, there could not have been a war between the two of them, hot or cold. There is one now, because there's only one enemy to globalization, and that is nationalism. That is its opposite. That is its primary opponent. Any manifestation of nationalism or regionalism. So like, you know, the Pan-Slavic movement, for example, something a bit above nationalism, but still taken into consideration. That will be an enemy. The only time that the West ever condemned the Soviet Union was when they threatened to create a trading bloc that would avoid the dollar and American involvement. Then suddenly they were a big problem. Otherwise, the U.S. traded very briskly with the Soviet Union. Only this period of time where Putin's policies have been orthodox and nationalist in most respects, anti-Zionist in almost every respect, only now do you have these sanctions, this rhetorical assault on Putin to the point where it's hysterical. The U.S. has declared war on Russia starting roughly in 2002. Every few months or so, John McCain will demand military action against Russia. And Russia from 2000 to today has been transformed from a fourth world backwater that it was, thanks to liberal capitalism being imposed on it, to the seventh largest economy in the world and the primary thorn in the side of the New World Order. There's no denying this. This has been Putin's point of view. The West condemns him for this every day. The United States is very weak. It is in debt. It has no political unity. It has no political legitimacy. And a war with Russia would be an absolute disaster. The U.S. would lose without question. I believe the U.S. military is a paper tiger. And because of Western threats against Russia, they have formed the Shanghai Cooperation Organization with China and Iran that would require a Chinese response if Russia was ever came under attack. So a war against Russia would automatically mean war against Iran, Kazakhstan, China, Belarus, Armenia. It would be a world war right away and one that the U.S. Cannot win. I might also note that when this so-called heresy was proclaimed by the Fanar businessmen, the Russian Synod condemned it immediately. They never accepted this as a real heresy. They knew exactly what it was. The Serbian church condemned it immediately, refused to have anything to do with it. The Romanian church condemned it immediately, refused to have anything to do with it. The Patriarch of Alexandria said that the only reason that they're promulgating this is to protect their investments. And even Antioch, believe it or not, at the time, a very healthy church body, accepted the decision but did not publicly state it, would not promulgate it. So it was really a dead letter from the beginning. The only reason it exists is so that these phony pseudo-intellectual clergy have something, a kind of religious conservative reason to reject nationalism. Philotism is a fraud. It doesn't mean anything. Synod of 1872 was not a real synod. It had nothing to do with religion or the Orthodox Church. And that these people should be embarrassed by their historical illiteracy, arrogance, and stupidity. And so I have convinced Matt Heimbeck that he has been excommunicated from nothing, that he was not a member of an Orthodox body in the first place. And now, thanks to the Greek gold calendars, he has found himself a home. There is no sense. I mean, the Fanar tried to claim that the Bulgarians wanted to kick out all non-Bulgarians from their church body. Of course, they said no such thing. The same stupid accusation is being made today. They're trying to claim that Matt Heimbeck wants to have a church of all white people or all Anglo-Saxons or something like that, and that simply isn't true. We respect the ethnic principle. We believe in ethnic organization. We believe in ethnic separatism and traditionalism. That has nothing to do with who could come to the gospel. Anyone could come to the gospel, and for any reason, so long as they accept the doctrine. However, the church will continue to be organized on ethnic terms, and it has been a tremendous strength to the church, as it's been a part of the development of strong nations these extended families, and the church, therefore, has become a part of the day-to-day life of the population. I want to make clear that the Orthodox Church is a political institution. It's not only a political institution, but it is that. There is no separation between the human man as a civic person, as a family man, as a religious man. These aren't distinct at their essence. There is nothing about the political world that somehow is separate from the action of grace, from Christ's action, Christ's saving action. Christ had two natures, the human and the divine. The human should be understood very broadly. It refers to anything that humans create, culture, the economy, government. Now, it may be true that the church shouldn't be involved in day-to-day politics in the sense of campaigns, elections, and voting. I have never claimed a tax exemption. I will not claim a tax exemption. I want nothing to do with the government. I pay my taxes like everybody else. As far as the government's concerned, I'm not clergy at all. Because if I were to claim that, I would have the state have a certain control over me. And one of those aspects of control would be that I could not be involved in politics as the IRS defines it, in terms of campaigns, elections, and voting. But when there are issues of justice involved, you know, things like feeding the poor, fighting usury, capitalism, the church has every right to be involved in the nitty-gritty of politics. And if it means that you can't have a tax exemption anymore, well, too bad. There is no aspect of human culture that is outside of the church influence. And certainly nothing could be more Christian than concerning yourself with justice. There is a reason that the prophets of the Old Testament are no longer read. And the reason is that they were national socialists. They were, using the term very vaguely, they were national in the sense that they were very deeply committed to the ethnic principle. Ezra the scribe, or as I call him, Ezra the holy philetist, condemned all intermarriage of Israelites with non-Israelites, that the faith should never be sullied by intermarriage, that the language was, and the legal tradition was so essential that any intermarriage was immediately condemned, and they had to divorce their non-Israelite spouse. Nothing could be more ethnic than that. Ethnicity and religion were one and the same as they are today. To be Russian, as Solzhenitsyn would say, is to be Orthodox and vice versa. The religious aspect is deeply ingrained in the Bulgarian, the Greek, Ukrainian tradition. There is not much of a separation. There can be no separation of Russian history from the Orthodox Church. They're one and the same. There is no Russia without Orthodoxy. It was one of the essential legal and moral elements that held the nation together. They're not separable things. So they're national in the sense that they were deeply involved in an ethnically pure Israel, number one. Number two, they were socialist in that they truly believed in economic equality. They rejected banking and usury. They rejected foreign trade. They rejected taking profit. The prophets could not have been more vehement, more harsh, more nasty in their condemnation of Israelites who tried to be like everybody else, who tried to be like all the other nations, who became pagans because they sought profit in international trade rather than being happy with what is the simple things. To maintain your wants as very, very simple and limited was absolutely essential to being a true Israelite as the Israelites of today, which are Orthodox people. We are the people of the Old Testament. We are the chosen people. There is no distinction between the Orthodox Church and the Israelites of the Old Testament. Of course, the modern-day Jews not only have nothing to do with the Old Testament, but they condemn in the Talmud. They condemn the prophets because the prophets did nothing but condemn Israel, or what we would consider today the corrupt aspect of Israelite life, which is found its expression in the rabbis, in the Talmudic Pharisees. That has nothing to do with the Old Testament. It's a negation of the Old Testament. So this is a reason why the prophets are no longer read, because they would have condemned every aspect of American life. They would have spit in the face of these liberal Americanist, capitalist, usurious modernist churchmen who dare to condemn others for believing what everyone believed just a short time ago. The ethnic principle is the most natural, ordinary, ancient principle imaginable. Now, maybe the state, in the sense we use the term today, those institutions of coercion, that may be more modern. But we're not talking about the state. You use the word nation, you have to be very careful in how you define your term. The nation is this cultural body, speaking the same language in the very broad sense of the term. It has the same, similar history, similar faith, similar outlook. But just like any individual person, there's going to be differences. There's going to be change over time. There's going to be differences of opinion, just like in our own psyche. Nations function and exist no different than we as individuals exist. We grow, we change, we have inner conflict, perfectly acceptable. That doesn't mean we're not an individual. And the ancient and medieval references to ethnic nationalism are everywhere. But because globalization and the forces of globalization, international materialism, dominate academics as part of their deal with the system, have to spout the idea that there is no such thing as nations. Let me remind them that if there are no nations, then there can be no imperialism. Because imperialism is only bad in that it crushes the independence of nations. If there are no nations, then imperialism can't exist. It can't be bad. That hasn't occurred to them. Nations are not imaginary any more than when we consider ourselves as integral individuals. But that thing is imaginary. These people, though, have no problem with stupid phrases like global values, or European values, or the sovereign individual, or, you know, the capitalist consumer. Those are constructs of the imagination. They have no problem with those, but actual real people manifest in an ethnic context, which is the only way that an individual can possibly exist. That is foreign to them. And it's foreign to them because many of them are urban, Judaic, completely alienated people. They're ciphers. They're neurotic individuals whose whole existence is serving others, serving the regime. So I use a term like regime or system with a capital R and a capital S. I'm referring to this coalition of power that is the engine behind globalization and the New World Order, the ideology that undergirds this capitalist drive. Capitalism, socialism, collectivism, individualism, these are all one and the same thing. They're based on all the same assumptions. Capitalism and communism are almost identical. They're both oligarchic. They're both materialistic. They're both obsessed with technology. They both believe in linear progress. They both define happiness and progress as, in economic terms, in terms of production. They see the individual as an abstraction, a unit of production. We could go on and on and on about how capitalism and communism are the same. Solzhenitsyn made this very, very clear. They have far more in common than they do in opposition. The alternative to this is the nation, defined as we've defined it. This is why the Orthodox Church is organized on ethnic terms. There is nothing wrong with organization on ethnic terms. I have never read a nationalist who believes that only members of their nation can be a member of the church. That has never occurred or ever been said by any sane individual at any time. Outside of long simmering historical claims, like, say, between Serbs and Croats or English and Irishmen, there is no hatred of outsiders. That's extremely rare. There is no sense of exclusivity or chauvinism. generally speaking, only liberals and Jewish nationalists seem to have that tendency. So they create these imaginary fictions, these straw men in their mind, and they pat themselves on the back by opposing this fake creation. And then they seek the approbation of the powers that be. And to a great extent, in the wealth of the Antiochian body, the late and unlamented Phil Saliba, the Metropolitan Philip, who died a multimillionaire, he was clearly has been rewarded by the system, and many of his hangers-on have as well. Now, I want to make clear, by the way, that there are decent people, Orthodox pious people within the Antiochian jurisdiction. Why they remain is a bit of a mystery, but it is not necessarily their fault. As I've said before, the true Orthodox movement, the anti-modernist old calendarist movement, has not succeeded in offering a rational alternative because of these divisions and these schisms. Allow me to recap here a bit. Number one, this is the first broadcast since 2012. And I wanted to thank all of those who have been writing me and asking me to return all this time. Now that my personal problems have been finally put behind me, I'm able to broadcast again. I'll be doing this on behalf of the Barnes Review, where I'm working again as a senior researcher in European history, as well as the traditionalist youth movement and the Workers' Party of Matt Hombeck as well, and any other body that wants to make use of these broadcasts certainly can do so, so long as my name is kept in the title. Number two, to show what nationalism really is, to define it the way it needs to be defined. You can't use the word nationalism in any old way. You can't just define it as you see fit. You have to be very explicit what you mean, and I've been very explicit about this. That's what the term means. It's a cultural, ethnic, religious entity having nothing to do with the state, but it is the cultural community. Number three, to make fun of the Antiochians in their smug pseudo-intellectualism, which is a kind of a hobby of mine. Number four, to show that this philotist nonsense doesn't exist, that the Synod of 1872 has no more Orthodox importance than my automobile, than the desk that I'm sitting on, the chair that I'm sitting on, my cat's litter box. They're pretty much equal to that sobor in terms of religious importance. And of course, finally, to give a sense of what I'm doing here. The Orthodox Nationalist is not a title that I use for myself. I don't, people seem to think that, and it irritates me. It's simply the name of the program. It's like the name of a journal would be. The Orthodox Nationalist is simply a recapitulation of the notion that Orthodoxy is ethnic, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Universality is very, very real. Christ came to save anybody who wanted to come to him. But universality doesn't mean abstraction. It doesn't mean cosmopolitanism. The abstract individual is an enshrining of the ego. That is a deadly sin. And that is an actual sin rather than philotism, which is a make-believe a construct of the Fanar in the 19th century, no different than a lot of these fairly well-off bourgeois Antiochian clergymen. They have more in common than we realize. And I want to give a sense of what I'm doing and what I'm all about here. It's been a while since I broadcast. By far, these podcasts have been the most influential thing for all my books, all my articles, translation, all the university that I've taught at. This is by far the most influential thing that I've ever done, and I don't understand why. I'm extremely gratified, and I'll repeat this over and over again, of those who continue to write me in this period of time, begging me. They were offering me anything just to get me back on the air again. or something about my delivery that a certain class of very weird people really responded to. And I think there's an appetite for this kind of discussion, this kind of lecture format, where fairly complicated historical and philosophical topics are broken down and made accessible. I've taught at 4 universities in my career, and I'm always in the top 1% of the student evaluations and of every university I've ever been at. I'm always the most, one of the most, if not the most, popular professor at every school. I certainly was at Mount St. Mary's University, and that caused a great degree of professional jealousy. But students had a tendency to tell me that you took complicated, often obscure historical things, made them easy to understand, and made them relevant to me. That these things, you know, history is about our struggles now. These aren't just abstract, strange hobbies of the eccentric. They can be that, but they're not only that. We study these things because the peoples of the Middle Ages lived more rational and intelligent lives than moderns. Mass society is mass death. So we have come to the end of the program. I want to thank everybody who has written me. I want to thank Matt Heinbeck and Matt Parrott, everyone at, of course, whatever happened to the Voice of Reason, I don't know. Wherever those people are, I want to thank them, if they're still around. I want to thank everyone who's been involved in the production here, and, of course, the Barnes Review. Since I have been on the air, we have lost Willis Cardo and Michael Collins Piper, both of whom were personal friends of mine. Willis hired me right out of grad school in 1999, and we became very good friends and very and comrades. And I miss both of them very much. And they gave me my shot, and I wouldn't be anything without those two. And I will always be defending their legacy and their honor. And now that I'm back with the Barnes Review again, part of my purpose is to maintain the legacy of both of those men. They were brave, extremely intelligent, very idiosyncratic individuals who recognized those same qualities in me. I thank everyone, and including my enemies. Stupid as you are, some of you do keep me on my toes. I thank you, and I will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.